In this episode, we speak with Dr. Sasha Hepburn, who teaches African history at Birkbeck University of London. We speak with Professor Richard Drayton, who is Professor of Commonwealth History at King's College London. We speak with Dr. Tim Livesey, who teaches African history at the University of Northumbria. And we speak with Dr. Olayinka Ajala, who teaches politics and international relations at Leeds Beckett University. In this episode, we look at two world wars and the Cold War, the role of Versailles, the Atlantic Charter, fighting on the continent, and the impregnable role of the Cold War. So now we speak with Dr. Sasha Hepburn, who teaches African history at Birkbeck University of London.
All right, so shall we start with World War One, World War Two, and trying to talk about basically the first half of the 20th century from, say, 1912 to like 1947, 1948, in your view, how important this was for the continent?
I think this is an incredibly important period of time for the continent in so many different ways. I mean, if we start off thinking about just the actual impacts of those three issues on people's lives. I mean, starting with the First World War, I mean, there was fighting on the continent with African troops drawn from West, East, Central Africa, Southern Africa, you know, pulled into this conflict that had originated in Europe. In East Africa alone, during the First World War, you know, I think that 100,000 African troops served, and there were around 1 million porters and labourers. The French sent 150,000 black troops from West Africa to the Western Front in France and Belgium. So, you know, that impact on the troops is massive. I mean, the conscription process was systematic. It was often brutal. It provoked resistance amongst African communities, with young men fleeing into neighbouring territories to try and avoid conscription. And there were also significant uprisings within a number of communities against conscription, but also kind of longer term grievances, and conscription kind of just pushed things over the edge. You know, uprisings in Nigeria, in Niger, in Mozambique. So, you know, that's an example of how the war was the kind of immediate cause of these uprisings, but really they were longer term, caused by longer term grievances surrounding colonial domination and exploitation. Thinking also, continuing with this issue of the thinking about the First World War, the impact on civilian populations, you know, economic hardship increased across the continent. Local economies were devastated by demand for food, cattle, and young men for fighting. And there were chronic food shortages during the war and afterwards. And this resulted in famine conditions in certain places. French Equatorial Africa, for example, experienced the worst famine in its history, and that lasted from 1926. That's an example of how the war itself and the immediate conditions of the war, you know, demand for food, cattle, young men, and scorched earth tactics that the troops on both sides were using caused, you know, extreme hardship and famine among civilians. The impacts of the war were, you know, too many to mention really, but just a few things to note were the First World War in many ways enabled a consolidation of empire. You know, the Europeans had been kind of engaging in this scramble for Africa since the late 19th century. And during the war, a number of powers kind of consolidated control over territory that they hadn't been able to control beforehand. We also saw the loss of the German colonies as part of the Versailles peace process. Those colonies were then designated to other European powers. So there was this consolidation of control and also a restructuring of European control on the continent. And afterwards, the European powers move away from kind of militarism and that era of conquest towards more sort of consolidation, stabilization, and really starting to exploit economies and move towards sort of like focusing on market forces. The impact within African societies, a key thing was increased politicization. Not only opposition to European rule, but also disillusionment with the chiefly class. And we see the emergence of new African political movements and existing movements becoming stronger and sort of campaigning for increased representation. So that's a number of really key impacts. And also, I think what we can see as an impact of the war is the influenza epidemic, because that epidemic came from Europe. It began in coastal areas on the continent, and then it moved inland following the transport and communication routes, which had been carrying troops and supplies during the war. So they're intimately connected. And now we don't know exactly how many people lost their lives from the influenza epidemic, but it's estimated that between 2-5% of the affected colonies, 2-5% of people died. So a range of sort of political, demographic consequences, but also this kind of consolidation of colonial power, as well as this rise in African politicization. And a number of these trends also we see during the Second World War. So like during the First World War, colonial powers used their colonies during the Second World War as sources of materials, so raw materials, agricultural produce. They used industry and kind of manufacturing sectors in the colonies, but they also used them as sources of labour, and particularly, recruiting soldiers. So the British recruited men from West and East Africa. They relied also on colonial agricultural and industrial sectors, so those workers as well. And nearly a million Africans served in the Allied forces. Others are conscripted for private employers. So there's that, again, that kind of trend of conscription, of, forcibly pulling, largely African men into the armed forces, but also there is evidence of younger people being pulled into these conflicts, and of course women as well in indirect ways by being forced to engage more in the kind of agricultural sectors, but also through conscription for private employers. And again, we have African troops serving not only on the continent but abroad, particularly in Italy, but also in Burma, with the British taking African troops over to Burma. So we've got African troops there involved in and fighting this conflict on behalf of the European metropolitan powers, but also, on behalf of their kind of colonial governments fighting in Europe and in Asia. Again, we see, significant impacts on civilian populations. There were, widespread shortages of consumer goods, high rates of inflation, urban residents experienced food rationing. And this, along with conscription and kind of this forced increase in forced labour that we see, and conscripted labour, again, provokes politicisation. It provokes people to turn to politics and engage in forms of worker militancy. So there were significant labour strikes during the 1930s and 1940s, including on the Zambian Copper Belt and amongst dock workers in Kenya. Support for African nationalist organisations really starts ramping up significantly in this period. And there's an increased realisation amongst nationalists that what they need to do is not only develop movements to oppose European colonial control, but they need to be thinking clearly about what their new independent nation states are going to look like, how they're going to be organised, what they're actually fighting for, not just what they're fighting against. And we see African nationalists voicing their demands not only in the colonies but in Europe. In 1943, a delegation of West Africans visit London to call for independence within 15 years. I mean, that call is not exactly, listened to at the time, but there's a very clear message coming from a range of different African political movements that they're expecting there to be a clear path to independence laid out by colonial powers, who themselves are, in the immediate aftermath of the war, determined to hold on to their colonies because they need to exploit African resources to help with metropolitan post-war recovery. So the Europeans want to hold on to their colonies, but they're aware that there is this rising tide of African nationalism and labour militancy, and they, try and figure out ways that they can kind of concede a little bit in order to provide a kind of like outlet for that buildup of pressure. And so what we see in the French Empire is, the French rule out self-government, but what they do in 1944 is grant each colony electoral representation in the Assemblée Nationale in Paris. And they hope that that will kind of provide African nationalists and political leaders with a way of voicing their concerns without actually granting real self-government. The British do something slightly different. They don't grant representation in the Parliament in Britain, but what they do is start to kind of slowly open up electoral representation in local legislative councils. An interesting and important result of this kind of opening up of electoral space, however small that was that it gives African nationalists yet another way to organise themselves. Because what we see is nationalist movements and groups organising around elections and trying to kind of increase their support base, get themselves elected, campaign for additional seats on legislative councils, to kind of have greater representation, and even in territories where elections weren't actually kind of instituted by the colonial powers, such as in the Portuguese territories, we see nationalist parties form and campaign for the introduction of elections so as to open up that political space and give colonized subjects more of a say in what was going on. So that's just a range of different impacts and things that I think we need to be thinking about, and links between those different global conflicts particularly thinking about the rise of African political parties. And of course, as we know, in the post-war period, they continue to grow in size and in importance.
Yeah. I mean, let's just talk a bit about that. Like, what kind of state did they envision, and what kind of state did they eventually create, because of the impact of experiencing empire?
I mean, there were lots of different visions at play, right? Lots of different potential futures that were being envisaged by different parties and different movements. And there are lots of variables here. I mean, it depends significantly on the kind of demographics and makeup of a particular political movement or liberation movement as to what type of future they envisage. I mean, we have everything from kind of more at the more sort of radical end of the spectrum. You see the emergence in the post-war period of Marxist aligned organizations like the MPLA in Angola, like Frelimo in Mozambique, who see their future as being one of Marxist revolution, of socialist style governance. At the other end of the spectrum, we have much more sort of small C conservative visions of what the future might hold. And particularly, we might think there of the examples from Kenya and the type of vision of the future that men like Kenyatta and the kind of elite political class in Kenya envisaged was a much more, in many ways, much more continuity than change. They wanted Africanization, they wanted to have democracy, but it was very much going to follow a more kind of small c conservative path. And so there are lots of different visions. I mean, of course, not all of those visions come to pass because we have movements and groups who are defeated, who don't succeed. You know, you have radicals in Kenya. Mau Mau, of course, is the kind of key thing we need to be thinking about there, and the kind of, you know, the fight for land and freedom that Mau Mau guerrillas were, what they were fighting for, that does not come to pass in independent Kenya. You know, those aims and frustrations are not in any way answered.
That's true.
So there's kind of, there's, you know, there are lots of different visions and ideas, but what actually happens during decolonization is something else.
Indeed. Indeed. And I mean, during the process of decolonization, there was an even bigger war going on across the world, which is the Cold War. And, you know, many African, newly independent African states were drawn into this battle between the Soviet Union and the United States. Could you talk a bit about this Cold War and its impact on the continent in specific places?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so firstly, just to kind of say something about the approach of the different Cold War blocs, you know, how they saw Africa from their point of view. And then I'll turn to think about what African leaders and movements were how they saw the Cold War. So, I mean, the United States had an anti-imperialist stance during the Second World War, particularly, you know, Roosevelt was staunchly anti-imperialist, and, you know, he very much voiced that opinion. Now, that anti-imperialism does continue post-war, but it becomes kind of, it gets kind of pushed down the US foreign policy agenda, because what really becomes their key focus is this perceived threat of communism and ways that they can contain and fight against this kind of fear of, you know, there being a domino effect and a spread of communism. So what happens within the US government is, on the one hand, they kind of maintain this anti-imperialist stance, but they are willing to provide support to European imperialism, because they think that the European powers will be able to sort of protect their quote-unquote less developed populations in Africa and Asia from communism. And so what we have is this contradictory approach of, you know, espousing anti-imperialism from the Americans, but also providing support and intervening on behalf of colonial regimes to, you know, to fight communist insurrection. You know, for example, the Americans help the Portuguese to fight against the Marxist liberation movements in Angola and Mozambique. Now, the USSR also presented itself as being anti-imperialist. It said that it wanted to, you know, support the liberation of oppressed peoples around the world. But Soviet support for, you know, decolonization and liberation movements was quite minimal in the early Cold War. It's really from the kind of mid-50s and certainly the 60s that it actually starts providing significant support for anti-colonial movements. And it does so in a number of ways, including by providing military training and supplies to a number of movements. In Angola, for example, the Soviets support the Marxist MPLA, while the Americans are supporting the Portuguese. The Americans later actually switched their allegiance to another African movement, the non-communist FNLA. And that's an example of how we see these Cold War rivalries kind of shaping intervention, external intervention, but also there's this calculation on the part of the Americans that actually decolonization is probably an inevitability, and therefore we want to throw our weight behind a non-communist African movement rather than the Portuguese, because that seems to be, you know, futile. So, you know, there are many ways in which Cold War rivalries shaped armed struggle and liberation wars across the continent. Now, African leaders were not puppets of the Cold War powers. You know, they quickly came to see the political ramifications of the Cold War and the potential opportunities that the Cold War offered. You know, some leaders were drawn to communism, not only as an alternative to capitalism, but as a way to, you know, truly break from the legacies of colonialism and the kind of colonial capitalist and European capitalist global economy. And examples include, Nyerere in Tanzania, Senghor in Senegal. And there emerged, you know, new forms of African socialism that were drawing on aspects of communist ideology, but also drew on aspects of African political organization and specific sort of political and cultural histories in those nations that pursued African socialism. You've got other leaders who, you know, sought to utilize Cold War rivalries to their advantage in a more kind of instrumental kind of way. And a good example would be Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, who sort of cultivated relations with the Soviet Union to secure development aid, but he also tried to maintain close relations with Britain, joining the Commonwealth, and also, you know, inviting in Americans to engage in kind of infrastructure projects. So he was very savvy in sort of playing off these different groups, not necessarily always successfully, but it's a good example of a leader who very clearly saw what potential opportunities those rivalries could offer him and his government in terms of their pursuit of development. And then we have leaders who use the Cold War to secure support for authoritarianism and repression of popular dissent. And perhaps the most notorious example would be Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire, who secured Western support for his regime in the mid-1960s and managed to maintain that support well into the 1990s. So there's a range of different things going on and different ways that African leaders were engaging with the Cold War. And I think when we're trying to understand the history of decolonization, but also the history of the types of governments that emerge in newly independent states, we do need to be thinking about the Cold War as an important kind of background, not because it determined everything that happened, but because it provided a range of different opportunities and possible options for African leaders.
About 10 million soldiers from all over the world lost their lives in World War I. It was actually called the Great War, because it was at that time the greatest war ever seen. Now, the horrors of the war and its aftermath lasted for decades, and immediately after the war, four major monarchies of Europe were toppled: Austro-Hungarian, German, Ottoman, and Russian ceased to exist as a direct result of that war. Now, one very important way of understanding the war is poetry. We had a lot of major poets, particularly British poets, who penned down what they felt about the carnage during the war. But one of the most interesting is a guy called Wilfred Owen. And in 1918, he said, "This book, this poetry book, is not about heroes. English poetry is not yet fit to speak of them. Nor is it about deeds or lands, nor anything about glory, honor, might, majesty, dominion, or power, except war. Above all, I am not concerned with poetry. My subject is war and the pity of war." Now we hear a poem by Wilfred Owen titled Exposure.
Exposure by Wilfred Owen. Our brains ache in the merciless iced east winds that knife us. Wearied, we keep awake because the night is silent. Low, drooping flares infuse our memories of the salient. Worried by silence, sentries whisper, curious, nervous, but nothing happens. Watching, we hear the mad gust tugging on the wire, like twitching agonies of men among its brambles. Northward, incessantly, the flickering gunnery rumbles, far off, like a dull rumour of some other war. What are we doing here? The poignant misery of dawn begins to grow. We only know war lasts. Rain soaks and clouds sag stormy. Dawn massing in the east, a melancholy army attacks once more in ranks on shivering ranks of grey. But nothing happens. Sudden successive flights of bullets streak the silence, less deadly than the air that shudders black with snow. With sidelong flowing flakes that flock, pause and renew, we watch them wandering up and down the wind's nonchalance. But nothing happens. Pale flakes with fingering stealth come feeling for our faces. We cringe in holes, back on forgotten dreams. Stare, snow-dazed, deep into grassier ditches. So we drowse, sun-dozed, littered with blossoms trickling where the blackbird fusses. Is it that we are dying? Slowly our ghosts drag home, glimpsing the sunk fires, glozed with crusted dark red jewels. Crickets jingle there, for hours the innocent mice rejoice. The house is theirs, shutters and doors, all closed. On us, the doors are closed. We turn back to our dying. Since we believe not otherwise can kind fires burn, nor ever sun smile true on child or field or fruit. For God's invincible spring, our love is made afraid. Therefore, not loath, we lie out here. Therefore, we're born. For love of God seems dying. Tonight, his frost will fasten on this mud and us. Shriveling many hands, puckering foreheads crisp. The burying party, picks and shovels in the shaking grasp. Pause over half-gnawn faces. All their eyes are ice, but nothing happens.
So now we speak with Professor Richard Drayton.
That's exactly the next point. You know, around the early 20th century, sort of empire had been consolidated across the world. And by 1914, when you have sort of European conflagration that lasts to 1918, a large portion of the world is drawn into this conflict. And the same thing occurs in 1939, which ends in 45 or 49, depending on what kind of historian you are. How exactly was this conflict, which is World War I and World War II, important for Africa and the Caribbean? What was the role and impact of World War I and World War II on the inhabitants of empire?
Both World War I and II were fought as total wars, as wars in which the entire society was mobilized behind the war effort. They were also wars which were fought through the currency of patriotism. You are fighting for queen and country. You are fighting for this nation in which you have a stake. So the First World War involves the mobilization of a very large number of conscripts across Africa by the French in particular, but also by the British. It involves the imposition of taxes to pay for the war, and to pay for this mobilization of troops across the colonies. What these colonial soldiers found was that while they left the colony as waving the Union Jack and saying we're going to fight on the side of Britain in this particular conflict, they found that this is true for British and for French troops. They found that when they reached the battle zone, they often confronted European officers who treated them with a great deal of contempt. See, there's a very famous story of when the West India Regiment, recruited in the Caribbean, arrived in Egypt. They marched from the harbor front singing Rule Britannia. Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves. And they were confronted then by a group of white officers who said, why are you niggers singing that song? And that was a rude moment of realization that their membership in this national community was in fact not one of equals and full pardoners, even though they were being asked to sacrifice their lives as equal and full pardoners. In the case of the Caribbean, you see that when the West India Regiment is sent to Italy, they're placed under the command of a white South African officer who does two things. He, first of all, he makes the West Indian troops operate as the porters of munitions under very heavy gunfire so that they're facing a great deal of risk and danger, which he's protecting his other troops from. And then the other ones, he sends them to perform latrine duty, to clean the toilets for the regiment. And this leads to a very famous mutiny of the West India Regiment, in which the junior officers gathered together. They formed an organization called the Caribbean League, and they proceeded then to commit themselves to the political independence of the Caribbean when they returned home. But they also mutinied against the army. So this is a very important moment in terms of the history of the emergence of anti-colonial politics in the Caribbean. But, you know, all around the world, this question is being asked. Marcus Garvey, almost exactly 100 years ago, in a speech in 1919, says, you know, we who have been resurrected from the trenches of France and Flanders demand that we should have our freedom. We have paid our due. One of the advertisements which Garvey would have in his newspaper, The Negro World, was a picture of a trench. And the slogan was, over the top, for what? Because during the trench warfare of the First World War, the soldiers would be persuaded by their officers in a kind of hysteria of patriotism to jump over the trenches with their guns to try to conquer the next enemy trench on the other side. Of course, a significant loss of life. So the question is being asked, what have we sacrificed for? And what we have in this aftermath of this First World War is the emergence across the colonial world of between 1918 and 1920 of mutinies of one sort, important mutinies in Egypt, uprising in Egypt against British colonial rule, strikes across the port cities of the Atlantic, and the emergence of modern trade unions and political parties. So the First World War has this extraordinarily stimulating effect in terms of bringing to the surface the contradictions of the imperial system and accelerating the development of forms of politicization among colonial peoples. Of course, it's not just true for political people in Africa and the Caribbean. The Australians and New Zealanders look at the First World War as the beginning of their own kind of national awakening because of the way in which they felt they had been treated by the British Army officers at Gallipoli and so on.
Exactly.
So the First World War ends with, and the interwar period is a period of significant kind of political awakening. And then along comes the Second World War, which has much the same effect in terms of awakening these new kinds of patriotism. But also, the other aspect of the Second World War was the way in which it showed the fragility and weakness of European empires, because in particular, in the case of Japan, the collapse of the European empires, French and British, before the advancing Japanese, was an important kind of symbol to colonial peoples of the limits of European power.
Exactly. And also, just to add, the consequences of both wars, so World War I led to the Paris Peace Conference, which led to the formation of the League of Nations. And then you had an independent nation like Ethiopia go into that and realize that, you know, it was constructed on the basis of racial hierarchy, because when Italy invaded Ethiopia, there was no, you know, major support. They had to get their own support independent of that from the British.
And they didn't get that much support either. I think that that what was conspicuous in the Italian invasion of Abyssinia in 1934-35 was that the British and the French actually, in the Hoare-Laval Pact, they actually allowed it to happen. They were, as far as they were concerned, the self-government of Ethiopia was expendable. And that they were far more concerned with keeping Italy within the European family. And I think it's worth remembering that they were, you know, while we think of the Second World War as a war in which Britain and France were on the other side of Italy, we must remember that a lot of people in Britain and France, particularly those in right-wing parties and of the older elites of these societies, were quite supportive of Mussolini. They thought that Mussolini was a wonderful man. So that from their perspective, African sovereignty was expendable. And this, of course, made a huge impact around the world because, you know, coming out of European colonial expansion in Africa, there were only two states that enjoyed a kind of sovereignty. One was Liberia under American patronage and Ethiopia. So the loss of Ethiopian independence is an extraordinary symbol to people across the African diaspora of the lack of respect which European empires had towards them, and it accelerates political politicization. In the case of Trinidad, there is a calypso that is written. A calypso is a form of popular song in Trinidad and in the Southern Caribbean. There's a calypso that is written in the 1930s called The Gold in Africa, which is a song about the Italian invasion of Abyssinia on the surface, but in fact it is also about the Europeans seizing the gold of Africa in a more general way. And the song begins in this kind of lament: the gold, the gold, the gold, the gold, the gold in Africa, Mussolini won from the emperor. But it develops by saying, well, if Mussolini wants expansion, if Mussolini wants gold, why doesn't he go to war with France or England or Germany? Now, to have a colonial saying in a song and with the entire crowd singing along with him that it would have been better if Mussolini had gone to war with England rather than going to war with Abyssinia caused a great deal of concern among the British colonial officials. And in fact, the calypso was banned from being played and being played in Trinidad. But it's just one symbol of the way in which we have a whole kind of Pan-African political awakening, which turns, as you were suggesting, on the Ethiopian crisis.
Exactly. I mean, Kwame Nkrumah talked about how one time he was passing through and he picked up a newspaper and he found out that Abyssinia had been invaded, and it made him so angry and he decided to dedicate his life to, you know, doing something really tangible. But then the end of World War II also ushered in the Atlantic Charter, which is the basis for the United Nations. And it also, you know, led rise to a lot of general strikes, anti-colonial movements. But how and why exactly was Africa and the Caribbean region given its independence by empire?
That's a very interesting question, because we must remember that as late as the 1930s, Jomo Kenyatta was asking the question, not how European colonial rule in Africa would be overturned, but how would we manage to stop Europeans from seizing more African land? How do you manage, in other words, to just keep things as they are and to stop what appeared to be a progressive extermination of African self-determination, as in the case of Ethiopia, and an extending European land grab in all of the cultivable regions of Africa. And of course, you know, jump forward just a quarter of a century, and we're seeing the political independence of nations across Africa and the Caribbean. So how did this happen? Well, we could begin really with that, the importance of that first colonial movement, where we talk, which we call sometimes primary resistance, so that we shouldn't assume that the memories of resistance to European power in the 1870s and 80s and 90s disappeared in thin air after there was a defeat. And I think the very interesting case for this is Zimbabwe, or what was then called Southern Rhodesia. That in Southern Rhodesia, there's a very important rebellion in Matabeleland in the 1890s, which is crushed by the British South Africa Company under Cecil Rhodes, and British control over that region is achieved. But those who were defeated did not forget that they had once fought for their independence. So that all across the colonial world, there are these memories of earlier periods of self-determination before the Europeans. There's folk songs sung, there's stories told of what it was like before there were these people governing over us. So that's an important resource there in the background. But more importantly, stepping forward, the experience of that First World War and interwar period, both the First World War, which I've discussed, but also the experience in interwar period of the economic depression and the way in which it imposed particular burdens on colonial peoples, to which we'll add what is arguably the most important single factor in this process, I would argue, which is something entirely outside of the European empires and outside of Africa, and this is the Russian Revolution. It's very hard to overestimate the importance of the Russian Revolution in accelerating the timetables for decolonization across the 20th century, and really accelerating the politics of reform across the world, because those polities that wished to preserve capitalism found themselves in a position of competition with the USSR, particularly after the Second World War, for the sympathy and for the ideological allegiance of peoples around the world. So that if we, right after the Second World War, there's an attempt by all of the European powers to reestablish the colonial system which had existed prior to the war, and indeed to intensify the degree to which they're effectively exploiting their colonies. So in the case of France, there's and the Netherlands and Britain, there's an attempt to kind of to industrialize and to develop the ways in which colonial economies can contribute to the development and the recovery of the metropolitan economies from the war. But they find themselves confronting local resistance of one sort or another. In the case of the Dutch, they are expelled from Indonesia by an insurrection. In the case of the French, they face the same thing in North Vietnam and in South Vietnam. It's not going to be the return to the old order. And eventually the French Empire will begin to crack in North Africa, in Algeria. But as early as 1950, one might have considered that it would have taken a very long time for the empires to end. But the 1950s is a decade of enormous acceleration in the timetables of decolonization, for which the Suez Crisis is an important symbol. In the Suez Crisis, as we know, Britain and France attempt to organize this little secret operation in which they arrange with Israel to create a crisis with Egypt. And then they were able to invade under the pretext of humanitarian intervention, not for the first or for the last time, putatively to restore order in Egypt. But nobody around the world bought that particular story. The stock markets plummeted, and most importantly, both the USSR and the United States said, "Nonsense, guys, this has got to stop, go home." And so in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis, we see a dramatic acceleration of the timetables for political decolonization in Africa and both French and British. The best article to read for this, if you want to follow this up, is an article published by Ronald Robinson and William Roger Lewis, which is called The Imperialism of Decolonization, in which Robinson and Lewis argue that what we understand as decolonization in the 1950s and early 60s was very much driven by imperial priorities. In other words, the way to save the most important economic and political interests of the European empires was to decolonize. That was the realization they came to in the 1950s. Better to grant state power of a kind to Nkrumah in Ghana, or in 1957, or to in Malaysia in 57 also, and in a rapid wave of decolonizations by France in 1960, than to either create a context of these societies becoming increasingly pro-Eastern bloc, damaging over the longer term our own economic interests and the strategic interests of the West. So it's in the context of this, of the Cold War, that Europeans changed their strategies with respect to countries within their empires, and they begin to move forward very rapidly on things which they had said might have taken 50 years. Let's add one last fact to this, which is that coming out of the Second World War, the political democracies in countries like Britain and France were seized by the politics of welfareism, both liberal and socialist, in which these societies were remade into societies which attempted to provide welfare and social security for their citizens from the cradle to the grave, as the famous expression of the time went. Mm-hmm. Now, what their politicians very quickly calculated was that if they were going to do this at home, they certainly were not going to do this in the colonies. So there's a kind of a separation of the accounts, which had always been implicitly there, but is now kind of explicitly thought through, that better to have every colony paying its own way, with its own diminished conditions of social welfare, than to dilute the kind of social welfare system we can create for our citizens here in France or Britain. So there are a lot of people who are pushing decolonization, in part because, to put it in simpler words, they don't want to pay for better healthcare, for better education, for better infrastructure in the colonies from which they have extracted so much wealth.
On the 3rd of September 1939, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain addressed Britain and its empire. He had this to say.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
So now we speak with Dr. Tim Livesey, who teaches history at the University of Northumbria.
Shall we consider World War One in a bit more detail?
Exactly. Let's.
So, if we consider World War One, first of all, We can see during the First World War, there's a really interesting organisation founded in West Africa called the National Congress of British West Africa. It was founded in 1917, so while the war is still going on, and it had branches in Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone and Gambia. And in 1920, the Congress presents a petition to King George V, the British king, calling for reform of British colonial rule. So the National Congress is calling for things like a greater role for Africans in colonial government, the establishment of a university in West Africa, and other demands. But I think the thing about these African demands at the time of World War One was that British colonial authorities in West Africa were generally successful in ignoring these demands. So the kind of change in the situation after World War One wasn't that great. And although the European colonial powers were weakened by their engagement with the war, they weren't weakened as badly as by World War Two. So during World War II, in contrast, we see the rise of a mass nationalism in West Africa. So an organisation like the National Congress of British West Africa during World War I, it was quite small. It was composed mostly of educated elite. But during World War II, we see mass nationalist organisations with a much larger and socially more diverse membership. So, for example, in Nigeria, the NCNC, the National Council of Nigeria and the Cameroons, is founded in 1944 by Herbert Macaulay and Nnamdi Azikiwe. So that's quite a big change, this switch towards a mass nationalism in West Africa. Another important change is that during World War II, large numbers of African soldiers were recruited into the European armies. So, for example, in West Africa, Nigerian and Ghanaian men are sent by the British Empire to fight the Japanese in Burma. And after the war finishes in 1945, these African ex-servicemen become a really significant force in colonial politics. So, for example, in Ghana in 1948, it's ex-servicemen who play a key role in leading the protests against British rule that lead to notorious police action, which resulted in three ex-servicemen being killed in Accra in 1948. These protests lead to significant reforms, including constitutional changes that hasten the arrival of Ghanaian independence in 1957. So, you know, comparing World War I and World War II seems like the much more significant turning point in Africa, and especially in West Africa.
Exactly. But can we just pause and talk a bit about the interwar years?
Absolutely right. I think that's really important, yeah, that it wasn't just about the two world wars. The interwar years were really important. And I would definitely stress the role of the Great Depression in the 1930s and its impact on West Africa. You know, when we think about the Great Depression, we might usually think of the Wall Street crash in the US in 1929. We might usually think of Western Europe, the impact of the Depression there. But the Depression was a global event, and it's interesting that West Africa and also the Caribbean was quite badly affected by the Depression. So, for example, in southern Nigeria and southern Ghana, the economy was quite reliant in some districts on exporting cocoa. So with the Great Depression, when the price of cocoa declines in the 1930s, then those cocoa planters in southern Nigeria and southern Ghana are quite badly affected. So in the late 1930s, in West Africa and also actually in the Caribbean, we see a pattern of strikes, of protests and of cocoa holdups, where cocoa growers refuse to sell their cocoa because of the low prices that they're getting. So those changes which we see as an effect of World War II, like the growth of mass nationalism, they weren't just a result of the war, but they were also the result of this background of the impact of the Great Depression playing out, especially in West Africa in the later 1930s.
Indeed. Also, you mentioned Herbert Macaulay and Nnamdi Azikiwe, two prominent men in West Africa, in Nigeria in particular. But then these men would go on to basically be the fulcrum of the states that emerged in the 1960s across West Africa. What kind of state did they seek to create, you know, around this point in time as they were fighting the British? What kind of system were they trying to create in West Africa before?
Yeah, good question. Like, although Herbert Macaulay didn't live to see an independent Nigeria, Nnamdi Azikiwe certainly did. And he went from being a journalist in the later 1930s to the first governor general and later president of independent Nigeria in the 1960s. So these elite nationalist figures like Azikiwe experienced the meteoric rise across their career. What kind of a state did they envisage? Well, I think it changes over time. And I think their first priority in the later 1940s and 1950s is securing independence. And we see this clearly in the case of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana as well. Nkrumah's priority was seeking political power, and then I think reforming the state was seen as something that could be done after Africans were in power. So I think these nationalists were prioritizing seizing power first of all. And actually, in terms of their vision of, for example, how to develop the economy of their countries, they were often in agreement with late colonial development policies rather than opposing them.
Indeed, indeed. That's very interesting. But then,
often,
you know...
Often, for example, if Azikiwe criticised British colonial development policies in the later 1940s, 1950s, it wasn't that what the British were doing was wrong, but rather that it was too little, too late, so that the British should be doing more to develop the Nigerian economy, for example.
Indeed. Many of them actually were in cahoots with the before the more radical people came along, many of them were in cahoots with the British establishment, like Herbert Macaulay, for example.
Absolutely, and they have been criticised. That generation of nationalists has been criticised in some quarters for not being more critical of the colonial establishment and working too closely with the colonial establishment. Even a figure like Nkrumah has been criticised in this way by some scholars in recent years.
Indeed. But then let's fast forward a bit to the emergence of many African states on the world stage. It was a real proliferation, if I may use that word, on the world stage. And, you know, around this time as well, empire was crumbling. You know, the situation that created many of these states was being relegated to the backdrops of history. And a new order was being created, which is the powers of the Soviet Union and the United States. And African states had to now wade in during this entire situation. In your view, what exactly did the Cold War do and how impactful was it for the continent?
Yeah, it's a really important question, I think. And the way you summed up the transition then, I thought was very, very effective. Yeah, Africa had been dominated by European imperialism from the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century. And as that international context fell apart, as European imperialism crumbled, the international context was dominated instead by the Cold War, the rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States. So the Cold War was a really important part of the international context in which most African nations won their independence. The Cold War has often been seen as having a devastating impact on Africa, and it's really easy to see why. Devastating civil wars in countries like Angola became proxy wars that were fueled by arms and other resources from the Cold War superpowers. So with Cold War superpowers and their allies backing different sides in these African civil wars. The Cold War also leads to support for authoritarian, undemocratic leaders. So a figure like Mobutu in Zaire, present-day Congo, was propped up by the US and their allies because they were seen as reliable opponents of communism, even if they weren't Democrats. Over the last few years, there's been a slightly different perspective on the role of the Cold War in Africa. An important work here is Westad's The Global Cold War, which was published back in 2005. And in this recent work, it's explored more the way the Cold War opened up some opportunities for Africans while foreclosing other options. So, for example, there's been some recent work on Africans who went to study at universities in the socialist world, in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. They won scholarships that were made available to African students as part of this Cold War rivalry to try and co-opt new African elites to support either communism on the Soviet side or Western-style capitalism on the part of the Western world. There's also been a really interesting new book by Lukasz Stanek exploring the role of architects and planners from Eastern Europe in West Africa during the 1960s and 1970s. So I think recently we've been developing a much more detailed understanding of what the Cold War meant to Africa and the way it opened up some opportunities for Africans. So for a time, some African leaders like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana were able to take advantage of Cold War rivalries to play off the US and the Soviet Union against each other. And for a while, Nkrumah was able to secure development assistance from both the US and Soviet Union at the same time. So there's no doubt that Africa's relationship with the Cold War is an interesting and important area of study. But I think my overall conclusion, to go back to your original question, is that although some Africans managed to play the Cold War situation to their advantage, most probably weren't able to do so. And Africa emerged from European imperialism into this Cold War international situation that in some ways was not too dissimilar, because in both the European imperial system and in the Cold War international system, Africa was marginalized by both of those systems.
Yes, indeed. And I'm very glad you mentioned the fact that architecture as well is very important, important site of contested realities for both people in Europe and in Africa.
Absolutely. Because if you look at the National Theatre in Lagos today, it's one of the most striking striking parts of the Lagos skyline. And that was designed and built by a company from Bulgaria, so in the 1970s. So even a part of the Lagos skyline like that has this quite interesting Cold War history.
Exactly, exactly, indeed. And even like a city like Abuja that was built from scratch and billions were poured into that. A lot of the major architectural firms from Eastern Europe. And if you look at the universities as well that are built in the 60s, many of them borrowed, you know, European values from Western Europe, borrowing that Le Corbusier's, you know, view of quadrangles and brutalist architecture, strong stone buildings. You know, you had different fights on what Africa should actually really look like on the ground, you know, through these ideological contests.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right in that when you're building a major new institution like a university, the architecture that you use in a way is expressing a vision of the future of the country and a vision of what the future of the country should be like.
Exactly. So,
architecture and the built environment was definitely an arena in which people debated what African futures should be like within a Cold War context as well.
Exactly. But let's talk a bit about the actual reason for the content, which was the battle of ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ideas are basically propounded by scholars and then taken wholeheartedly by policymakers. So let's talk a bit about the scholars and the policymakers around this period. You know, why in certain parts did they believe in, because some people actually really did believe as Marxism as a way forward for their own part of Africa, why others believed in a capitalist system as a way forward for their own Africa. Why did they exactly, you touched a bit about people who studied in different places, went there and then, you know, immersed in that system, came back with a belief that this is the right system. But what other reasons, what other books were proliferating around this time? What major scholars were there that were reading? You know, what major ideas by African scholars was floating around this time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, there's no doubt that some African countries became more invested in a capitalist approach to development. Other countries became more invested in a socialist approach to development. And that's very much down to the internal politics of those countries. So, for example, when Nigeria becomes independent, the government is the big governing party is the MPC from the relatively conservative northern Nigeria region. So it's because of the politics of that party that Nigeria adopted a more capitalist approach to development in the 1960s. So those kinds of explanations can be found in local politics. And in fact, the Nigerian government in the 1960s, after Nigeria had just become independent, was incredibly hostile to the Soviet Union. For quite a few years, the Soviet Union was trying to set up an embassy in Lagos, which was the capital at first of Nigeria. And the Nigerian government wouldn't even let them set up an embassy. And when the Soviet Union was eventually allowed to set up an embassy, the Nigerian government gave them a very small number of diplomatic number plates compared with the British and American embassies. So yeah, there was still this kind of clear sign to the Soviet Union that the Nigerian government was very suspicious of them. I think over time, many African countries learned to be wary of both the Soviet Union and Western countries like the US, Britain, and France, in that, you know, it became increasingly clear as the Cold War wore on in the 1960s and the 1970s, that these foreign countries were ultimately interested in Africa for their own ends. Mm-hmm. And that I think that led to a certain disillusionment amongst African politicians and intellectuals, which you see in the rise of thinking about, for example, dependency theory in the 1970s, and a kind of thinking which saw neither the capitalist route exemplified by the US or the Soviet communist route exemplified by the USSR as really offering a meaningful model of development that would work for Africa and Africans.
Exactly, exactly. I think they became more aware. Some used it to entrench themselves in power, and you know, some actually were actually seeking the best possible alternatives when it comes to sourcing funds for major projects, be it dams or railways or whatever. But then, around this period as well, like you mentioned, that the conflict was, you know, there were conflicts in Africa because of the Cold War. You mentioned Angola, for example, and even like the Nigerian Civil War also has that bent to it as well, as many conflicts did in the 60s and 70s. You know, are there any conflicts you can speak to around this period that wholeheartedly embody the ethos of the Cold War and across the continent?
Well, I think the Angolan Civil War that we've already mentioned is a really good case study. Mm. It's not so much that the Cold War started these conflicts, but that the Cold War interference probably made them much worse, in that arms and resources were poured into what were originally civil wars between different factions of anti-colonial parties and freedom fighters. But this interference in the Cold War context turned what were African civil wars into much larger proxy wars, which were part of the global Cold War. So the fact that you had foreign countries like the Soviet Union and Cuba in the case of Angola, and and also South Africa in the case of Angola as well, pouring armaments and resources into these troubled areas made civil wars much worse and made them go on for longer.
Exactly, exactly. That is very spot on. I guess another question to ask around this period is the international order. You know, we didn't just have the US and the Soviet Union, or we didn't just have many Africans. We had other states as well, like across Northern Europe. We had the structure of NATO. We had things going on in the Middle East. We had things going on in Asia. How were many of the African states relating, in your view, to other states outside the purview of the Cold War?
It's a good question. I think when African states are first becoming independent in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there's an optimism that African states can carve out a distinctive role in world affairs. And this is reflected in their activism in the United Nations. It's also reflected in events like the Bandung Conference, which exemplified, I guess, what we would now call a global South agenda.
Exactly.
In that there were efforts to generate Afro-Asian solidarities, for example, which would represent global South interests in the global arena. And this is also reflected to an extent in the non-aligned movement, which is gaining momentum at the same time in the late 50s, late 1960s, into the 1960s. I think what we see in the 1970s are efforts by the superpowers to close down these avenues of global South expression and also global South activism in world affairs. So, for example, as the Vietnam War gets worse, the United States effectively disengages from the United Nations, and the United Nations becomes a less important arena in global affairs. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, one of the reasons for this is that the old powers, if you like, countries like the US, Britain, France, which were in, you know, formed a major bloc within the UN, say, in 1945, when you have all of these new countries becoming independent in Africa and Asia, by the 1970s, the old traditional Western powers are in much more of a minority at the UN. So it's no coincidence that it's at that moment a country like the US starts to disengage from the United Nations.
Exactly. That's a fantastic point, actually.
The Cold War was a stalemate that occurred between the communist USSR and the capitalist United States. It lasted from the tail end of World War II, towards the end of the late 1940s, to the very beginning of the 1990s. Now, for Africa, there was nothing cold about the Cold War. It was a hot war. A lot of people passed away and were affected by the machinations of these two major powers. We hear now from the Prime Minister of Nigeria at the time, at the early part of the Cold War, when he was interviewed on his stance regarding the situation.
Do you hope to be speaking to the General Assembly yourself?
I hope to, yes.
I don't know whether you noticed a remark made by Mr. Nehru the other day that when a neutral country joins a neutral bloc, it ceases to be neutral.
Exactly. I entirely agree with him. I told reporters in Lagos the same thing yesterday evening. They said, well, what about the neutralist group? I said, well, they are committed.
So what kind of neutralism do you envisage? You really think it's going to be
possible? I don't like this idea of neutrality. I don't like the word, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's the wrong word.
How do you hope to maintain your real independence of the political
we
world?
We want to pursue an independent view.
As we can see, or as history eventually tells us, neutrality became a farce. Every single nation was squabbling to find their own way and to situate themselves in a way that would prevent them from being on the receiving end of these two powers. As they say, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. So now we speak with Dr. Olayinka Ajala, who teaches politics and international relations at Leeds Beckett University.
Look at the history of many African states or many African countries, you discover that it seems as if the colonial nations left in a haste. After the end of the Second World War, the key colonial nations in Africa were France and Britain, although countries like Portugal also had colonized some countries in Africa, but the two main countries were Britain and France. Mm-hmm. And after the end of the Second World War, both countries came out weak in terms of economic standing as well as military infrastructures. So it became unsustainable for them to continue to hold on to the colonies. And this also coincided with a period where the continent of Africa was beginning to produce elites in terms of educational. People were already getting very educated, although still Western education. So the combination of the availability of a group of people within Africa who were already agitating for the end of colonialism, coupled with the economic standing of Britain and France at the end of the Second World War, made their position on holding on to Africa untenable. So they were no longer able to hold on to the to continue colonialism, and this resulted in the series of independence African nations got from the 1940s, mostly between the 1950s and 1960s. Many of the countries in Africa became independent.
And let's talk now about the broader sense of Africa on the world stage in the 20th century and the Cold War and Africa's place in it. Could you tell us a bit how, you know, what the Cold War was and, you know, how important the struggle between the US and the Soviet Union was for the African continent?
Okay, thank you. So the Cold War was a period of tension, kind of geopolitical tension between the Soviet Union and their allies, as well as the United States and their allies. So these were the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. And this happened it started at the end of the Second World War. So although the exact time it happened is still being debated by several actors or several historians, but it was after the Second World War. So what happened after the Second World War was there was a void in the world leadership. The countries that used to be the most powerful countries, Britain, France, they were weakened at the end of the Second World War. And this created a kind of like vacuum in world leadership. And in order to fill this vacuum, there were two main blocks, the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. And so the Eastern Bloc was the Soviet Union and their allies, and the Western Bloc was the US and their allies. And there was a kind of struggle to fill the hegemony left by the previous world powers. So that was how the Cold War started. And occurred until the Cold War was active until 1989, 1990, 1991, thereabouts. That was a brief history of the Cold War. So in terms of how Africa was impacted by the Cold War, there are two main avenues. So the first was the fact that after the end of the Second World War, and the Cold War coincided with the period when many African countries gained independence, and there was kind of shift from many African countries to align with either the Eastern Bloc or the Western Bloc. The reason was that many African countries wanted to move away from the colonial nations and build new partnerships, build new diplomatic relationships, and build new economic ties, which they felt was necessary or essential for them at the end of colonialism. So for the Eastern and Western Bloc, Africa was up there for grabs because of the availability of natural resources, the population, and the fact that the many African countries were just becoming independent and they were kind of desperate for allies. So this led to a situation whereby the soul of Africa was fought over between the Eastern and the Western Bloc. And so that was how African countries became embedded or became entangled in the political calculations of the Cold War. For many African countries, aligning with either of these blocs was an opportunity for development, opportunity for economic advancement, and also economic opportunity for military, for the develop of their the development of their military. Because during the colonial era, most African countries depended on the military of the colonial nations. So many of them had very weak military infrastructures or military formations. So aligning with either of these blocs was an opportunity to actually strengthen the military and also to maintain sovereignty and independence. However, this was not the case because both the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc were not sure if the Cold War was going to degenerate into an all-out war. So in their desperation, they were throwing resources at many African countries. So for instance, if the government of an African country is supporting the Eastern Bloc, groups within the states would then emerge, which would then get support from the Western Bloc. And that was how many African countries were polarized. So you have the states supporting a bloc, and then a group within the states would then emerge, which would then support the other bloc. And this led to several civil wars within Africa because people that felt disenfranchised during the independence. So there were groups of people between many African states that felt they fought for independence. They were part of the group that advocated for independence, but they felt that they were sidelined after independence and they did not reap the benefits of governance. So many of these groups broke off from the states, formed rebellion against the states, and then aligned with opposing group of the Cold War. And this resulted in conflict in many African states. And some of these conflicts actually still impact negatively on African countries till now, because many of those rebel groups formed during the Cold War still exist till today. And this continue to create conflict in many African states. Secondly, the Cold War also, just like the Second World War, ended abruptly, and the financial compensation or the income that was coming from either bloc ceased immediately at the end of the Cold War, leaving many of these countries also in financial stress or distress, which then resulted in protests, conflicts, and in some instances, eventual takeover by the military. So you can see that all these things actually shape the way the continent of Africa is till today. So major issues like the Cold War, colonialism, in many instances, still explain the level of international relations and also the standing of many African countries to date.